Okay, this is October 26, 1989. I'm Bill Jones, and I'm interviewing Lynn Hansen Prom. And Lynn, my normal mode of operation is to simply ask the interviewee to give us a brief sketch of your life, where you were born, brought up, where you went to school, where you've worked. And after we get that, we'll have some more specific questions.
Okay, I think first of all I'll tell you a secret, and that is my real name is Ethelyn Prom. Mm-hmm. And when I was in high school, some friend of mine shortened it, just took off the Ethel part and gave me Lynn. So legally, that's my name. I was born and raised in Duluth, Minnesota, one of four children. I went to school at University of Duluth. At that time, it was called Duluth State Teachers College.
Oh, really?
And I was one of those two-year associate degree people.
It wasn't a part of the University of Minnesota, though.
No, not until the... In fact, I think it was the year that I left.
I hadn't realized that.
That's in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
So I left the university at Duluth and with that two-year degree and went to Superior, right across the bay, and taught in Superior, Wisconsin for a couple of years. But before I get into my educational history, I'll tell you a little bit more about my family. My mother is still living. My father passed away just 3 years ago now. All of my brothers and sisters are either in education or the ministry. I left Minnesota, or left Duluth, and went out to Montana when I was still young after teaching in Superior, and met my future husband there, who was an educator also, and married. And just a brief, quick summary of my life in the last 40 years. We had three children who are two. I have two daughters who are both married and both have are in education. One teaches in Phoenix, Arizona. I just returned there and spent last Monday teaching in her class for her.
Fun.
Just for fun, right. And mm-hmm. I have another daughter who lives in Wadena, Minnesota and teaches there. And I have a son who's an architect, landscape architect, and he lives in San Diego. In 1971, my husband passed away. After a four-month illness. And so then I was at a crossroads with my life, took a year off, came here on campus, and finished up my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And did some teaching here for the college, supervising student teachers and teaching a couple of education courses.
Did you do the
master's
in elementary yet then?
Supervision and administration.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And 4 years after I was widowed, I met and married a man who has a construction business here in Moorhead called Cameron Foss Construction. He has a partner and the two of them own the business. And he has six children. So together we have nine children and we have also together have nine grandchildren.
Mm.
So we expanded our family fast.
So
that briefly is, I guess, a quick sketch.
Well now, your present situation, you you retired from formal responsibilities, except now you're working part-time.
I work full-time.
Oh, is it full-time?
Oh, yes. I took an early retirement at Moorhead after teaching here for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Nine of those years, I was with up at Washington School teaching elementary, various grades. I didn't stay in the same grade very much. And then after 9 years, I was very fascinated with gifted education. And I took some courses from B. Kranz here, who was on campus, and decided to focus my energies there and was invited to begin a program for gifted education in the Moorhead Public Schools. So for 15 years, I worked in gifted ed. I started from scratch with no program at all and built it up. And now they have a very viable program I'm very proud of. It's called STEP, Project STEP. And I did that for 15 years. And then when I retired, in fact, I was going to continue because I have a lot of energy and my husband is busy with business. And I thought, as long as I'm in good health and still love what I'm doing, I'll stay in the field. Well, then Concordia approached me and asked me if I would like to join their department. And Dr. Marilyn Guy had asked me that about 4 years ago, and I didn't dare leave the program at the time, or I thought I would just collapse. You know, it's one of those things. It's your baby, and you're afraid if you go away,
they'll... It takes a while.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I got an assistant, and so after I got this assistant, I could see she could take over very well, and she's doing a wonderful job. And so then when I found out that I was eligible for an early retirement, I did that and went over to Concordia. So I'm there full-time. This is my third year.
Okay. And what are your responsibilities there?
I teach a social studies methods class, and I teach two reading methods classes. One is a diagnostic remedial reading, which we're just in the process of redesigning and redefining. And another one is reading in the content areas. Then I supervise student teachers. Mm-hmm. This semester I have 7 student teachers, and then we have a program called ESTAB for sophomores, and I supervise them on a kind of a, I don't know what you call it, rotating basis.
I see.
Yeah.
That's just kind of a initiation into
right. Although they do,
classroom.
They end up doing, they have to teach one class a day.
I see.
And they're there on campus, they're at the schools 5 half days, mm-hmm. and then we supervise them when they're out in the schools, and then they're back on campus, and then they take coursework mm-hmm. for half a day, and then I teach those methods courses then.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about teacher preparation a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's wonderful that someone who has been an active and successful teacher is now preparing teachers, and I'd be interested in your view, first, a comparison of how you were prepared mm-hmm. In order to enter the profession as to what happens now.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of swings, pendulum swings, and I'm terribly excited about what's happening now in education. I think we're really on the right course. I think one of the things happening, which I've longed for, is accountability. That's kind of a dirty word, but it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And I also see that what's happening now is the focus on meeting the student's needs rather than trying to fit the child into an already set curriculum or fitting the child into a schedule or a program. And I think there's going to be a lot of breakthroughs. I can foresee lots of changes, even in the school year. This 9-month school year is silly
mm-hmm.
because that's been designed for farmers, and we're long since past that. And I think it's going to happen. All right. But I also believe that I had probably the best teacher preparation for its time that anyone could have way back in my days at Duluth, because I had a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
I had a person who, I'm not sure if she did this to everyone. I felt like I was her only student. I was in her home many times. Her name was Miss Smith, and she's also the founder of, one of the founders of the Minnesota chapter of the Delta Kappa Gamma professional organization, which I belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
And I belonged long after, I joined it rather, long after she was dead. But when I was reading about the history of it here, there her name cropped up mm-hmm. and I wasn't surprised.
No.
She was a real pro. And I felt she took a particular interest in me, and maybe that wasn't so. It's one of those, she was that kind of a special person. But she lived and breathed education, and she gave me that same interest.
Mm-hmm.
So that I always wanted to do more than what was required. I was always interested in reading what was going on in the profession. I joined professional organizations, and I had friends who did the same thing in our class. And it was a small class, probably 20 and 24, I've forgotten now. But we went to visit schools, and we'd come back and talk about what we'd seen. One of my vivid memories is that I did a student, it was called practice teaching at the time, in a little town right outside of Duluth, and the name escapes me, but I'll remember it. I have very fond memories of that. I lived right in the center of downtown, not downtown Duluth, but West Duluth, and we didn't have a car, and no one did in our neighborhood.
Sure.
We had wonderful public transportation, streetcars or buses, you know. And I had to go to this little town to do my student teaching, and there was a teacherage there, and but no place for me to stay, and the town really, that's all it had was a store, I think, and a school, and that's what it still is today, I think. And so I lived at home. To get there, I went to the corner, got the bus, took the bus to the top of the hill, got on a train, and rode this train. I suppose it was half hour, 45 minutes at the most. got off the train, and the janitor met me at the school and took me to the school. And then I reversed that on the way back, you know. Mm-hmm. And I did that every day then for 6 weeks, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, that was my first experience in student teaching. My second one was right on the campus in a regular campus school.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where Miss Smith was my champion. Because I got into a situation teaching a class of, it was, I believe that was the second grade class. And, no, the second grade class was out in the country, and this was the upper grade. And I loved it. I just thought the kids were wonderful. And I suppose as I look back, probably I acted more like the kids. I mean, they thought I was okay, and I thought they were great.
Sure.
And my supervising teacher talked to me one day and just burst my balloon. She said, "You'll never make a teacher. I'm going to advise you now to get into something else. You are having too much fun in this room. You're not taking this seriously." And I thought I was taking it seriously, but I was having a lot of fun with them. You know,
sure.
Well, she misread it, or I don't know. At any rate, I went out of there just absolutely
flattened.
Oh, was I?
Mm.
Well, I went right to my advisor, Miss Smith, and I just burst in and I was crying and telling her that what my supervising teacher said. She said, "Come with me." She grabbed me by the wrist, and we just strode over to that campus school, and she burst into that room, and she just said, "What do you mean by telling this to this young woman, you know?" And she said, "I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to pull her out of here." And that's what happened.
Mm.
I have such a vivid memory of that, because I thought these were professionals who had lived and worked together all the time, and the risk she took to do that.
Oh. Talk about advocacy for Wasn't that though?
Right.
Yes, that's incredible.
And when she wanted me to teach in a country school. She thought we should all have experience in a small school. But one day we heard there was an opening in Superior, Wisconsin. And four of us, all of us were going to be through with our two-year degrees. We got in a friend's car and we went over there. And the superintendent was the one who interviewed. And he came to the outer office and he said, "Well, I can't interview all four. I only have one opening, and it's a second and third grade combination. And the best, quickest way for me to do this is to ask which one can teach their own music." And my hand shot up. I had quicker reflexes than the other three because they had just as much musical background as I did. And he said, "Okay, I'll interview you first." So I went in and interviewed with him. And he said, "Well," he said, "I'm going to hire you." He said, and he opened the door and he said, "Thank you for coming, ladies," but he said, I've decided this is, I'm going to hire." I had to ride back in that car with those three without an interview.
What a downer for them. Huh?
Yeah, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I got, that's how I taught. Then I taught there 2 years in South Superior.
Mm-hmm. Now, those were times when it was difficult to get a teaching job?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of these associates, now this is getting the beginning of the time where they wanted you to have a four-year degree.
Oh, sure. And you were just had the two-year
That's
certificate.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so you just didn't expect to get a job in a city.
Mm-hmm.
And Miss Smith was very disappointed that I had done this.
She wanted me out in a country school.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was after I got the job, she came to visit me in my classroom and observed me then. So you see what interest she had in this.
She was ahead of her time in a way.
Yes, she was the one that was doing what we're doing now.
Exactly.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And encouraged me to go on, you know, and get my degree,
mm-hmm.
Which I did, of course, eventually do. But she was, after 2 years, then I decided it was time to go elsewhere. And then I went out and took a job out in Montana. And by the way, I went back then to school to Valley City.
Oh.
Because I met a friend who's still teaching in Fargo. She also taught in that same school I was at in Superior, and she lived out in this area. So she said, "Come with me in the summer, and we'll go to summer school." And I did that 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I met my husband, and that's how I ended up staying this part of the woods.
Oh, I see.
But your original question again was comparing the education, so that you see there were a few things back there they did that I thought they lost for a while.
Well, and of course, the hard thing to do is to know whether you can generalize on your experience
at
Duluth, because you...
I don't know. Yeah. I always felt...
Nevertheless, you saw, you had an ideal experience.
Exactly.
Which you would like to perpetuate,
exactly.
I'm sure. Yeah.
I know of no one that made me feel like a real professional and that it wasn't just a job.
Mm-hmm.
And also had such... was able to give me a vision of what she saw. In fact, I have a poem that she said to me once, or wrote it, and I don't even remember, and it's just stuck in my mind. It was, Lynn is a little blonde of whom we all are very fond. She has talent galore and will have lots more, and her name will become renowned. Isn't that interesting?
It certainly is.
I don't know.
Did she have poems for any of the other students?
I don't know.
Don't know,
see,
huh?
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But I was at her home many times, and mm-hmm. with others, you know. We were invited as a group, and we talked education way
mm-hmm.
back then, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as I say, this being this clinical experience was just extremely important. And the fact that she visited after me, after an induction program, if you will, way back then, and I know that was not formal. I know
mm-hmm.
that. She came to my house, by the way, because part of one of our requirements in her program was we had to have a kit with materials that we were collecting, you know, for elementary education, anything to do with bulletin boards or interesting articles and so on. And my dad made me a wooden box with files set compartmentalized
mm-hmm.
box.
Mm-hmm.
And... it was too heavy for me to take it, so she came to my home one evening and looked at my materials in that box.
Well,
and that was at the other end of town, you know?
Sure, sure.
So she got to meet my parents that way and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And nowadays, you think that in some respect, the sort of ideal that she, at least that you experienced with her, is in evidence to some degree?
I see it coming, yes. One of the things that I've noticed, for example, in the work that I'm doing right now, is the concern about seeing and trying to help each student's potential, and also we start really early at Concordia to try to counsel them either out
mm-hmm.
or to do some thinking and to look at some other options, and I think that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Smith, her name was Dorothy. Dorothy Smith also was really very careful to continue to tell us that teaching is a way of life. It's not a job. It's not a career as such. It's a way of life. It's a lifestyle. And I think when I see what's demanded of teachers today and what's going to be, it really is going to be that way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's the exciting part of it. That,
sure.
To me, that's where the fun of it is,
yeah.
when you can put your whole...
Yeah.
self into it.
But it is a calling.
I really think so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think so.
And that leads me into another question. As you think of those that you went to school with and your experience
mm-hmm.
at Duluth, and look at the young people that you're dealing
mm-hmm.
with now, how would you compare them as far as their attitudes towards education and their potential as teachers and so on.
It's kind of hard to generalize, but I
mm-hmm.
will say this, that I think the students, the people that I was with years ago, seemed to be better prepared when it came to being able to write. Their writing skills were better. And I think...
Even before they...
Yes.
Yeah, they came with those skills.
Yes.
In other words, yes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I still think that the ones that were in our group, the small group, came knowing that it was going to be really a dedicated, all-out effort, and that to be a professional, you did read journals, you read, you know, books, you went to conferences and so on. We seemed to have that way back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw falling away from that later on, but I think it's coming back here, too, now.
One of the things, of course, that's different is that back in those days, there were very few professional opportunities for women.
That's right.
And there's a wide variety
yes.
of opportunities now.
Yes.
And thus it would seem almost inevitable that was a selective factor that made a difference in the
mm-hmm.
the quality. Your best, most able young women couldn't go into accounting
exactly.
or engineering
exactly. right.
they went into teaching or nursing.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
But, you know, when I think of the cadre of women that I've known through the years who have been the type I'm talking about, like a Dorothy Smith, I think of people here on campus, you know, like Ruth Hansen, Betty Bergford,
B. Kranz.
Yes, sure. Some of those people. Yes, and the one who just passed away last summer, you know. Can't say her name. Oh, she was here for years and years and years. Some of these women never married. Their whole career, the whole life, you know, their life was just revolved around their profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying there's room for it all, you know, and I believe that wholeheartedly. But it's kind of a mindset that you have, that you're going to be your way of life.
Right. As you think in your career now, clearly you started just immediate post-war.
Right.
And there was about 10 years where the profession wasn't growing at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then, 10 years is a little extreme. I'm thinking about college, maybe 5 or so years before the baby boom,
kids start to move in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you went through, you were certainly a part of a situation that was great expansion of education. Just incredible expansion, building schools all over. And
look at Moorhead, once had 11 elementary schools here.
Yeah.
Now we're down to 4.
Yeah. What happened educationally, do you think, during that expansion period?
Well, we didn't do a very good job, I don't think.
Why not?
Well, I have lots of theories about that. One of the things that happened in education was that people who wanted to make more money and were rather either tired of the classroom or thought, here's another opportunity for me to get out of the classroom and stay in education, I'll go into administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe a school is only as good as the principal. And I think, and during those years, we had some very weak principals. Some of them are still here, and they've grown a lot.
Mm-hmm. But their motivation was wrong, as far as you were concerned.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. And without good leadership, you just don't make it.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you ever tempted?
To get into administration? Mm-hmm. Yes and no. I think if I wouldn't have gotten into gifted ed, I probably would have gone into that. What I really wanted, my vision was that I wanted to get into curriculum development and work in curriculum. I like to write, and I like to work writing curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's what was my main thrust in gifted ed, was writing differentiated curriculum for gifted. And I love to do that. And when I saw what was happening, and thank goodness we're getting away from that too, is this textbook-bound business, you know, where they just stick with the text and page by page, and you ask a student, ask a teacher, what are you teaching in social studies? And say, oh, I'm on chapter 4.
Yeah. And if that is truly their attitude, it isn't very scintillating for anybody.
No, I guess not. You know. Right.
Anything else? You talk really about the necessary emergence of all kinds of new leaders, and some of them weren't ready and had maybe the wrong motivation for moving.
I think also during that period of time, education kind of in the public's eye was not so important. And we still have a long way to go.
So that...
priorities there.
Being a teacher, you felt, was not regarded
with
the same...
Right. When respect. I first went into teaching, you know, my goodness, you were treated with such respect and awe.
Mm-hmm.
And on the street, men would doff their hats. And then it definitely declined for a long time there. Mm-hmm. I think we could have saved the situation myself by involving parents way back then. We should have involved the community in education early, early, early. Because I see so much difference when we do involve people.
Mm-hmm.
That's making a big difference.
Now, certainly the PTA was alive and well during that period, wasn't it?
Well, it was alive and well, but it was so divorced from what really went on in the classroom.
Okay.
They would have a program, and you would meet the parents, and the parents would meet the teacher, but it wasn't anything like it is today.
Mm-hmm. Well, how are the parents? I'm out of it long enough.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me tell you a few things.
The grandchildren.
A few things that are happening. We have a lot in this area. We still have a long way to go. In fact, I was talking to Dr. Trokel, our superintendent, this morning about my experience in Phoenix, and I was telling him that one of the things that I just loved was what my daughter is doing and what she tells me they all are doing. And I don't know if they're told they have to or not, but every child has homework. And the district has given every child, it looks like almost like a little briefcase. It's a little leatherette case. Hmm. And it has the stamp of the Arizona Public Schools and a place for them to put their name in, so it's easily seen. And inside is on one side is the place for the homework assignments, where the parents have to sign their name every day that the child has done it. And the other side is a little pocket for a book. Now, this is elementary, and I'm not sure what happens in junior and senior high. But the child is expected to read from that book either to the parents, or the parent has to read to the child.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a place for them to tell how many pages they read. They don't say how many pages you have to read. It's just that you have to do this.
Make it a matter of record.
That's right. So that's one thing I think that's just really wholesome. There's no reason why a child can't do 10 minutes in homework. And the purpose of this, and I talked to a principal there, the purpose of this really is to let the parents know what the child is doing in that classroom, that they are expected to know their addition facts, or they are expected to know what a noun is, or whatever, you know. That's the number one purpose. And I think that's a wonderful reason to do it.
Absolutely.
And it might take 10 minutes. Now, I have two grandchildren there. One is in kindergarten. He came home with his homework.
Oh,
very
really?
Important, you bet. And it was a book that he's not reading yet.
No.
But the parent read the book to him, and then he had to read the book to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a simple little book with a few words in it, you know.
Yeah.
Look, I see, you know, sort of thing. And lovely pictures in it and so on. And then he'd done his homework and his mother could sign the page. He also had a worksheet to do one night. And it was, what he had to do was find pictures, all kinds of pictures in a magazine, and paste it on this page of words that began with the short I sound. And I said, oh, Joshua, you were not going to find many pictures with eh, you know.
Yeah.
And he was telling me what to look for because the teacher evidently had taught it that day. And so he says, but not ice, Grandma, because ice is not eh, you know.
Well,
so that's their homework.
Oh, that is intriguing.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
So that brings the parents. And then there's a note in there that started out right, I suppose, the very first day they brought homework, saying, we're in partnership here.
Mm-hmm.
This is what this is, you know. Mm-hmm. Together we're going to, your child's going to learn.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one thing. The second thing that I thought was great is that they have a policy where my daughter collects all the papers that the child does during the week, makes sure everything is corrected after, if they make a mistake, it gets back and they have to recorrect it, or correct it. And then the papers are gathered together, and on Monday it goes home with a note, and it's like a report card. And the note says, your child's effort in school was, and there's a place to check. Your child's behavior in school was, place to check. And his work is either not complete or is complete, and then there's room for comments. And then she writes down, for example, spelling, three words missed, and then the paper is right there. Or needs to practice his number facts in the fours or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that goes home once a week. Now, it's a tremendous amount of work.
Oh, that's just what was going through my mind.
A tremendous amount.
That takes care of a good chunk of your weekend.
You bet. She's there almost every Saturday, but so everybody else is there, too,
mm-hmm.
she said.
Mm-hmm.
And she loves it because she said the parents, she's talked to parents already, and they think it's the greatest thing in the world.
You bet.
And so she said conference time is going to be easy because we know each other now, and they know what I expect, and they've seen the papers, and there's no guesswork, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes sure she puts praises in there, you know, for the child
sure.
has been having trouble and now he's doing well. She puts that in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed one said something like, Jason works well unless he sits by his friends or something like that. So, see, when I see that, then I see an alliance here between parents and children. And if we do that, parents are going to support the schools. Mm-hmm. And what we forgot to do way back then was absolute isolation. You know, we never, school is school and home is home, and
was,
we didn't.
It was the task of the professionals, and they didn't need or want anybody else to be involved. Is that it?
A lot of teachers still don't want that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they don't realize how much easier their job can be if we do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's coming here. I talked to Dr. Turkle about that today, and he said, yes, that's, we're working on that sort of thing.
Mm.
The other thing that I see that's happening, and it's, I think it's really great, is outcome-based education.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for that. And Minnesota's a forerunner in this, you know.
Sure.
And there's just a real good article in the last, I think it's the last Minnesota Monthly, about Minnesota's outcome-based education. Now, I helped write outcomes for social studies several years ago when Ruth Randall had some of us go down to the State Department to write these outcomes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a horrendous job. Can you imagine writing down all the outcomes for every grade level, for every subject?
Oh, terrible.
You know, what do we want kids to learn?
Yeah.
And when do we want them to learn it?
And how do you evaluate and how whether they've learned it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But you see, we're getting it to be manageable instead of being so nebulous as to what do you expect in grade four and what should they learn when they graduate from high school. And we kind of know now, and I think mm-hmm. that's really a very hopeful thing.
The well, let's just kind of continue our historical overview now for a minute, and then I'd like to get into some more specific curricular things that you've been involved in. We went through this tremendous expansion period, and then when we got into the mid-70s or earlier, everything collapsed.
Mm-hmm, it sure did.
And again, I presume that had an impact on the profession, and
I don't suppose there's ever been a time when the morale was so low.
Mm-hmm.
It's a time that I kind of sneaked around corners and was kind of hard to find when the administration came around, because we were in the gifted ed program was getting underway,
mm-hmm.
and programs were being cut.
Sure.
And I had met with the school board several times, and it was up to decide if this program should be cut or not. And finally,
you had to fight.
Yeah,
you
did. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that one of the school board members brought up said, we've been cutting other programs by eliminating one person or two people or whatever. He said, if we cut this program, we have no program. And so they allowed it for another year, you know, but I never knew. Every year I had to
go in. Same old battle.
Yes, right. And that will continue forever because people don't understand gifted education needs, the needs of a gifted child.
Let's talk about that for a minute. We are essentially a society that believes in equality of opportunity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And some people interpret that as not selecting what you might call an elite for special
mm-hmm.
sets of
right.
experiences. How did you deal with those? Well, I'm sure those arguments you've heard a million times.
Gave many a talk on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been approached, even today it happens, with kind of a snarl in the voice. You know, what do you mean by gifted? Isn't everybody gifted? And mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And I like to clear up a couple things right away when I do that. One of the things I tell people is I never say a child is gifted. I never talk about the gifted child. I always talked about a gifted program.
Mm-hmm.
The program was for children who have special gifts. And there's a big difference there. When parents would say to me, or other relatives would say, well, I have a gifted granddaughter, or my son is gifted, I'd say, don't put that burden on your child.
Mm-hmm.
This is a gifted program, and we do work with children who have academic gifts. And it's a wonderful gift to have, to want to learn and to like to learn and to be able to learn. You know, that's really what it's all about. There are a lot of other gifts that are as important or more important in this world, like empathy and caring and, you know.
Sure.
But when a child has academic gifts, then we have to say, what does that child need because he has this? So the program is not based on this child deserves to be in the program. It is not a badge of honor or anything like that, and it isn't a reward. I had a hard time with teachers on that. They would say to me, well, Jimmy can't come to step today because he didn't get his work done.
Doesn't deserve to come.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I had to really educate teachers, and they have caught the message, and we don't hear that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I would say to parents, just like some children need speech, or some children need special help in reading, your child needs special help also because he has some needs. And those needs are very difficult to come by in a regular classroom when a classroom teacher has such a wide range of abilities and a wide range of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that's the certain to have the short shrift of it all would be the bright child, because most of them suffer fools gladly. They will put up with it, and they will find some things to entertain or to pass the time. But the sad thing about it is that sometimes, if they sit through that often enough, the love of learning just goes away, and they learn to just do mediocre work. They learn not to put effort into it. They learn not to be proud of any work that they've done, because they know in their heart, was nothing to it, you know. So our focus always was, we want to stimulate, we want to challenge. And so when people would say, well, what about a child who, can any child who wants to be in it, be in it? I said, if he wants to come and visit sometime, and I'll guarantee you, any child who thinks he wants to be in it, if he doesn't belong, he's not going to want to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then we'd try that.
Sure.
And once in a while we'd have a parent who moved in from another area that say, my child was in a gifted program in Billings or wherever, you know. And we'd look at the record would say, well, it doesn't look like it to us that he belongs, but let him have a day here. The pacing is faster. The challenge was there. Our expectations were higher. We wanted them to, we expected them to follow through. They had to come to an conclusion, and we always looked for excellence.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't accept work that was done sloppily.
Mm-hmm.
And I could get really tough with some of those youngsters, and they'll tell you to this day that they love step because they love the pacing. They like the excitement in the classroom, but they work really hard.
It isn't for everybody.
No, absolutely not. It's like being a violinist, or, you know, you can compare it to many, many things.
Yeah.
So I was able to get, you see how by using that kind of an explanation, we were able to, within the school district anyway, and with some parents, we were able to help them understand what it was all about. But the many people in the community will never understand, because we don't value that here. You know,
no.
We value the sportsman. You know, we talk about gifted programs. Look at the basketball team. And I hardly ever use that.
Highly selective.
Yeah, right. And I don't use that very often, but once in a while, when if somebody can get my goat, I will use that.
Sure. Now, you've gone through, experienced some changes in approach and curricula related to some of the major subject matters, too. Reading, mathematics.
You bet.
You want to just give a little sketch of where you were and where you are now as far as reading, for example?
Okay, yeah, right. That's a good one. Reading is probably changed. We've learned more about reading in the last 5 years than I think we ever knew before.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes such good sense. And I say to other professionals too, how come we never thought of that years ago? What I'm talking about is prior knowledge, and how a child who can start school and do really well decoding and learning the basic sounds and can read pretty well at grade 1 and grade 2, starts to slip in grade 3 and gets further behind in grade 4, and by the time he's in 6th grade, he's 2 years or more behind. And we never figured it out. The reason he's behind is because he doesn't have the experiences, he doesn't have the stimulation, and he comes from probably a background that is very limited.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that lack of prior knowledge, he reads and he doesn't know the vocabulary because he hasn't been exposed to a lot of those things. And so we're beginning to see that one of the ways that we need to do to build up that prior knowledge and to help children be able to know what they know and to know what they need to know.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do here is to build up their experiences. And that's why this literature-based reading is, program has come into being now. Now, Moorhead's changed their whole reading program this year. And they're now going into literature-based language experience approach.
Hmm.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens. Because yeah. I predict the reading scores are going to go down. And they're going to get really paranoid and upset about it. Mm. It's going to level off and it's going to be fine. But we are not spending the time right now on... they're doing some things. Some classes are doing a lot in decoding and a lot in learning the basic, the fundamentals of sounding out words and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just go by the language experience approach or the literature based, you don't get into that much. It's not in the teacher's guides.
Mm.
And so...
Unless the teacher is pretty well committed to that,
right,
as
and
a
really
necessary
knows
dimension.
Yes, and
how to do it.
Exactly,
sure.
Exactly. And we've got a lot that do, but we have some who don't. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But they've done a lot of studies to show that when you do it this way, using language experience, having the children actually go to a museum and learn about words that are in a museum, like curator. I just heard that the other day in a classroom where I was observing a student teacher, and the story was about a curator. Well, she asked somebody what it was, you know, and right away they talked about the docent at the
Yumcombs. Yeah, sure.
You know, well, those words are not, you know, you don't toss them around all the time. And if a child was just going to learn to decode that and spell it out or sound it out, doesn't mean he's going to understand to be able to read it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're knowing now that that is important. So we're not going to see that gap or that decline, I don't think, as much as we did before when we simply taught it the old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it old-fashioned. I guess that's the best term.
How about your reading classes that you teach now?
That's why we're revamping our diagnostic and remedial reading course.
Mm-hmm.
Because helping students, in the remedial student, the way it's traditionally been done, using workbooks and more drill, isn't making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to many remedial reading teachers and they'll say, I've been working with this kid for 3 years and he's not any better reader than he was when I got him. He just, you know, goes in one ear out the other.
Mm-hmm.
He'll pass the test, but a week later he forgets it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're starting to look at other ways to help a child learn and read. And one of the ways of doing it is this literature-based, where they isn't it true, if you do a lot of it enough times, you're going to become skilled at it.
Mm-hmm.
And reading is a skill after all.
Mm-hmm.
You learn to read by reading, so let's read.
That's right.
It makes good sense. Another thing that I'm doing right now that's my favorite subject to teach is reading in the content areas. What I'm doing there, it's primarily for junior and senior high people who are going to go teaching in the junior and senior high. And it's helping them to see that not every teacher needs to be a reading teacher skilled in decoding and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
but helping every teacher understand that they cannot assume that every child can read at grade level. And so what we do in that reading for the content areas is learn how to fit the needs of the student by maybe changing the assignment, maybe giving them a study guide, or there's 100 things. We learn strategies to help students be able to read a content text, make
mm-hmm.
sense out of it, so that they can learn the content, whether it is a biology class or an algebra class.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding that to be really exciting.
How about math?
Mathematics has changed a lot in that we use a lot of hands-on stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to use flashcards, and that was about it, I guess. There's a real change in the math textbooks and the math materials now that come from publishing companies. And I think it's healthy, and that is a child in first grade could learn algebra. We don't call it that, but they actually are using formulas, and they're actually learning at a very young age the formula way of solving problems,
mm-hmm.
finding the missing number and so on. And same thing with geometry. We're teaching geometry way down in the grades now.
Mm-hmm.
Not telling them that's what it is,
sure.
but they actually do it. And then using concrete materials to teach abstractly, and that's, I think, a very healthy thing. And I remember when I taught years ago, you know, it was turn to page 56 and do problems 1 through
sure.
12. And I'd walk them down the rows and mark them wrong, and the child would have to correct them. And next day was the next page, you know.
Yep.
And now we're not doing that.
One of the other things that we probably should talk about, too, is the impact of technology. And, of course, mathematics enters in there.
You bet.
What's the present status of the calculator as far as student use?
You know, that's still such a controversial thing.
Is it?
Yeah. Some of the best teachers in Fargo and Moorhead are encouraging children to use the calculator as efficient, accurate, and when you get out of school, that's certainly what you're going to use.
Sure.
And so let's become friends with a calculator. But I was in a classroom one day where the student teacher told me that the first thing the teacher said, I don't want to see a calculator in this room. So, you know, it differs.
Some divisions there.
Getting to computers.
Yeah, let's talk about technology.
Yeah, right. I think it's interesting that in Phoenix, I was actually in Mesa, they have a computer room that is rarely used, and it is not used at all in grades 1 or 2. I think they might start in grade 3, but my daughter hasn't heard anything yet. And it's not, if it's used, it's more as a diversion and something that if you want, it's a plus if you want to do it, fine. Mm-hmm. If you don't have time, that's
enrichment,
better.
But
enrichment,
not basic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Moorhead schools jumped into it, you know, with both feet. And they have keyboarding at a very young age, and they learn how to do that, and then they get into computers. Something has to give. And so many of the teachers are backing off now,
mm-hmm.
and saying that whenever a child needs to have a computer to, say, write a report and use a word processor, that's the time for him to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be too concerned that he doesn't know how to do it in the primary grades.
Yeah, don't teach the tool until they need the
tool. Exactly right, mm-hmm. exactly right. So I don't know what's going to happen in that case. I mm-hmm. think there's some other technologies that are more important.
How about the whole AV scene?
Yes, that's another thing. Perry Public Television's programs in the afternoon. When I first was exposed to that when I was still teaching in the classroom, we were told we had to use that, and every Thursday, whatever, we had to watch the program, and I'd watch it, and I'd think, these kids go home from school, and they watch television all evening, you know, and here we are in school watching this program, which is not good. It's something that I could tell them in 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and I really felt very uncomfortable with it, except for a couple times during a science thing or something that you cannot do in the classroom, then it's great to have it, but their language programs, I thought, were poorly done. The children were not involved in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have, I think the programming has improved a lot, but it's being used with lots of discretion. And I don't know if it's, I haven't heard whether that they've been told they must use it or whether it's, again, an enrichment. I just don't know. But mm-hmm. it doesn't seem to be used very much.
Mm-hmm.
I can see other places to use it. I think this interactive TV is one of the best things that happened.
Mm.
That's going to really grow, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a wonderful teacher in service when you don't have to go on site to a campus. You can interact with a professor.
Sure.
You know. I think that's going to be a real good thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the status of the profession as you watched it develop. Of course, one of the things that happened during your career is that teachers organized.
Right.
And were you involved in that? And did it make any difference as far as your career?
Well, I guess I'm not the one to really. what should I say? I am not a strong supporter of the organization. They've had some growing pains too, I guess, and I think some of the advocates have been too radical. And I guess that's the way change has to occur. We need radical people, but what really turned me off was the strike.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most traumatic experience to go through.
From a teacher's point of view, I think it'd be very interesting to get that on tape, is to just what the trauma was.
Yeah. You know, they took a vote.
That's a major historical incident.
Oh, you bet it was. You bet it was. They took a vote and said, I don't remember what the note, overwhelmingly voting to strike. And I don't know if people were honest later, but I did not. I voted not to strike. And everyone I talked to said they voted not to strike. So I kept wondering, where are all these people that voted to strike, mm-hmm. you know? And I was at Probstville at the time. That's where my office was, and that's where I had a classroom for my students and gifted, and they would come from the various schools to a center at Probstville. So I had to march with the Probstville people, and it's one of those times when I wished that I would have had more guts than I did and just simply refused. The reason I didn't was because my program was so tenuous at the time, and I needed the support of the teachers, or if the teachers don't support a program, you might as well forget it. And so I weighed it, the balance, all right, which is more important, the kids in this program or your own feelings about this. And so I did march, but I definitely was not, and people knew that too, that I was doing it out of duress more than an agreement. The whole time that this strike was going on. I think the majority of teachers were really feeling, number one, scared because they didn't know what the outcome was going to be, and it was their livelihood. And it was just came down to whether we eat or not. You know, it was really very, very traumatic. The strike went on long enough so that there were people who felt that I'm really going to be in trouble because I've got bills to pay and I have my rent and, you know, all that. And
sure.
So that was, I think, the number one reason why it was so upsetting to most teachers was the financial aspect and not knowing what the outcome was. Mm-hmm. The second thing that was very traumatic, I think, was the fact that there were teachers who did not behave well. I remember as I walked the picket line, I would talk to people, and I would try to get them to see that don't take this personally. You simply are doing it because as a group we're going to show that we are, you know, we're not satisfied. So, but be objective about it and don't take it like it's a personal affront. But they did, you know, a lot did. Mm-hmm. And so there were tears on the picket line and some terrible things happened, you know, like throwing stuff at the buses that were coming in with substitute teachers and so on. There are people who don't speak to people today because of that. That feeling like the community didn't value you, mm-hmm. The people were against you, you know, that sort of thing was really very real, too. Mm-hmm. And then we had, as I said, I mentioned, we had some who behaved very badly. And they would come and try to rouse the rest into this frenzy almost, you know. And we're going to meet at the so-and-so parking lot, and we're going to go en masse to where these people are, and we're going to do this, you know, and we want you to join us. And people were afraid to talk to other people because you weren't sure which side they were on or whether they agreed with you or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember one time walking with a teacher who was divorced and was supporting her children and barely doing as it was. And I made a sort of a Pollyannish, as I look back, it was a statement to her that, well, this will soon be over and it's going to be all right. That's the way everything turns out. It always will turn out okay. You know, this sort of, and she just lashed out on me. You know, she said, you have no business talking to me that way. She said, you have a husband and, you know.
Sure.
And she was right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very difficult time. And the newspapers, you know, would come out and look anti-teacher and,
So it was a pretty heavy price.
Yeah, it wasn't worth the price.
Mm-hmm.
No, it definitely wasn't worth
it. And, you know, what lessons can the profession learn from an experience like that? I guess it's the question that everybody has to ask themselves. I'm not sure what the lessons are.
Well, we have to do a much better job of selling the public the importance of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think this alliance with parents and letting them know what's going on. I just heard the other day that our legislature in Minnesota is very upset with teachers right now because we still say we need, don't have enough money. And I'm with them saying that money is not the answer. We don't need to pour all kinds of money into the schools. And they're saying, we want to see some accountability. After all, we've poured in this much more money. We should be getting more for our money than mm-hmm. we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I think we have to show them that we really are doing something with this. That's why I'm pleased to see accountability rear its head here.
Now, accountability, do you mean by that performance on standardized tests? Is that?
Well, I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no doubt that that does show up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I mentioned this, but again, in Arizona, I thought was interesting is about 3 years ago, the scores in Mesa, the language arts scores had gone way down. And so I don't know whether it came from the superintendent, the curriculum director, or whether it was just this local school. I'm not sure. But at any rate, every day my daughter has to have on the board or on the overhead a lesson so that when the children walk in the room, the first thing they do is sit down, and it's called DOL. Directed Oral Language. And I didn't remember what was on the first day, but the second day when I was there, she had a sentence on the board that had no capitals. The child came in, sat down, while she was taking attendance and attending to things, getting things ready, the children were copying the sentence correctly.
Mm.
And they did that for five sentences. Sometimes mm-hmm. it would be a comma missing. Sometimes it would be a misspelled word.
Mm-hmm.
When they did the five, then it was time, by that time she was all ready to go, and then they had started reading class. They have no milk break. They have no, like we do, we have a stand, she has a stand and stretch break and do a few exercises, but less than 5 minutes, and back they go again. And when they got back from that stretch break, she said, all right, take out your DOLs and we'll correct it. And the child, she chose a child to go up and erase the misspelling or the apostrophes were missing or whatever,
sure.
and capitalization, and correct it. And the children corrected their own.
Mm-hmm.
That goes in the folder to go home.
Oh, yeah.
The scores have gone up dramatically since they do that.
Is that right?
So you see, that is a performance based on achievement
mm-hmm.
tests.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that makes good sense, that you're saying we're not doing as well here. We're going to have to put some emphasis on this, and let's go for it. You know?
How is Moorhead done as a school system during the years on a comparative basis within the state, if you look at accountability?
Oh, yeah, I've been to many. It's amazing to me the, the variance in the effectiveness of schools. From some small town schools, I used to get around a lot because I was asked to put on workshops for gifted education and
mm-hmm.
In service for teachers, and so I did a lot of that. So I got to see a lot of schools, and I saw some really poor ones who were way back uninteresting, not stimulating, not at all. And Moorhead was always right up there.
Mm-hmm.
Moorhead's always been willing to try innovation. They've got a superintendent now that is extremely interested in looking ahead. He does a lot of future studies, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I'm impressed with that because you have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look toward what's going to be like in the year 2000, and I think
mm-hmm.
That's important. As I see it, where it has to come, again, going back to the principals, that's where it has to come. And they have to be the inspirers. And so the superintendent's job, I think part of his job, has got to be to in-service or to make sure his principals get out and see what's going on. And then to allow the teachers to go out and see what's going on and then to bring it back. And that's happening in Moorhead a lot now.
Mm-hmm.
I think 2 years ago they spent more money for in-service than they had ever had before. And that's encouraging because you need to know. And we can't just stay in our own little town and just continue
yeah.
doing what seems to be working.
Yeah. And those schools that were kind of sad, obviously, they weren't getting out.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, one of the legacies we have from the Department of Education is 4 years or so of pretty serious criticisms of education
yeah.
being voiced, particularly by Bill Bennett, but There's an element of crisis that is constantly entering in now whenever you're discussing education.
Right.
Is that valid? Does it apply to the schools within our region? Why is there this terrible crisis atmosphere that you sense in a lot of the publications?
Well, you know, we aren't sure whether, for example, some people think we don't have to even have methods courses. A big waste of time.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, New Jersey, for example, Governor King said anybody who's a college grad ought to be able, if you're a chemist, you ought to be able to teach chemistry mm-hmm. in high school. And
but taint so. But some of the things that I think that are happening now are that we do know now what makes an effective teacher. I think we have a pretty good handle on that. And I'm not saying that Madeline Hunter is, you know, big around here right now. I like a lot of what she has to say, but I'm not saying that we have to just follow exactly that. But people like her
mm-hmm.
who have been able to articulate what the effectiveness instruction really is. We used to have people who would go into the classroom and didn't know what to look for. And now we do, and we can pinpoint it exactly what mm-hmm. we need to be done, what needs to be done to make the teaching effective. So I think Bennett needs to find out about that sort of thing too. I think people who are criticizing our educational departments need to know that. I also believe that we have to do more in helping our students have a good liberal arts background first. I think that's really essential.
General level of learning.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. We just can't allow people to go out in the field who don't have that kind of a solid background today.
Mm-hmm.
It's you can have all the methods in the world, but if you don't have that background, I think that's really a weakness.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered a lot of topics, and I'm gradually running out now. But one of the things that I always do in these interviews is say, okay, I'm running out of questions, but there is an open agenda item here, which you're welcome to fill. Are there some things that you think we should have covered and that you'd like to?
I mentioned one thing that comes to mind. We've come a long way when I think about the difference in my first contract and my later contracts. Well, not my first contract, but when after 2 years in Superior, I went out to Montana and taught in this small town. I was making $1,800 a year in Superior, Wisconsin. And I was raised to $1,900 a year the second year, so I got a $100 raise. I was invited to teach in the small town of Montana for $3,100. I mean, that to me was out of this world, you know.
Yeah.
So I
that
went
was
for
in
about,
49?
That would be 49.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I went out there and interviewed, and in the contract it said that I would refrain from smoking in public, and I would not be seen in the local taverns, and I would direct the Presbyterian church choir.
Well.
And so.
And if you were a Roman Catholic, or.
Then you don't teach there. But it was a 5-man school board, and 3 of them were Presbyterians, and they needed a choir director, so they threw it in, just in case. So I directed the Presbyterian church choir, and just to be stubborn then, I left there and went over to my own church, which is a different time, or a slightly later time, and went mm-hmm. over and I went to my own Lutheran church.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be something today to see that in a contract?
Yes. There have been some radical changes in
right.
the expectations at a community level.
That's
has
right.
Teacher.
I've had a wonderfully rewarding career. I was awarded given an award 2 years ago. I don't know if you heard about that.
No.
But the Chamber of Commerce for the state of Minnesota honors teachers, a group of teachers from Minnesota every year.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing it. They did it for the metro area for several years, and then they expanded it 2 years ago. And so some of my friends nominated me, and which is no easy task. It's a large endeavor because there are many, many pages of things they had to do. They didn't tell me about it. And then I was called for an interview in the summer, and I went down to St. Paul for an interview. And they had 140-some nominations, and I was one of the 19 to be interviewed, and then later one of the 12 that made it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down to Ordway Theater in the following September and received the award, which was $4,000.
Oh, wow.
And that was absolutely incredible. The person who started all this, I believe, is the man who was at the time president of Justin's.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few other men who are in the chamber there who decided they wanted to reward teachers in Minnesota for excellence. So it's called the Excellence in Education Award. We got a little statue, which we have dubbed the Eddie,
mm-hmm.
for education. And we had two of our people this year who were nominated and who went down for interviews that didn't make it, but we hope will submit their names again. And we had one person last year who also went down for an interview and didn't mm-hmm. make it. But it's quite an honor, and it is
exciting.
Terribly exciting, right? Mm-hmm. The news media made a big thing out of it in the St. Paul Press, and of course, you know,
that must have been happening when we weren't in the area. We were gone for a couple of years, you know, so I wasn't aware of that.
Well, the person that got the award before me was a very young teacher, and so we all had to make a speech, acceptance speech, and she said, "How wonderful to get an award like this at the beginning of my career." And when I got up, I said, "How wonderful to get this near the tail end of my career." So that was a very special thing, and I really felt very honored to receive that.
Clearly, you have enjoyed your career.
Oh, I guess. I guess so.
And clearly, you have arrived at this point, and you... still like children?
You bet. You bet.
Yeah. And like the thought of preparing others to go out and work with children.
Well, as I say, the education has been very good to me, and I've had a wonderful career. I can't believe it's nearly over. Went very fast. Doesn't it go fast?
No.
And I have energy and good health, and as long as I do that, I think I'm going to stay. Mm-hmm. I've been asked now for 3 more years, so...
Oh.
I probably will sign another contract. Yeah.
Why not? Uh-huh. Right. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
I enjoyed visiting with you. You ask very good questions. It wasn't hard to go on here.
It wasn't hard because you stimulate those questions.
Well, great.
Okay. Well, thank you.